Phillips. Again, it is normally on his website close to $400. It should be $4,000, but you can get it right now for this donation of $150. We do need your email address. We want to get this to you right away. And there's nothing to send. There's no environmental, hazard. You know, it's good for the environment because we're going to get this to you right away. Please call right now. The number to call is 516-620-3602. That number again is 516-620-3602. And if you're placed on hold, please just be patient. Again, I think that there is no mistakes. I think that everyone who's hearing this is supposed to hear this.
Yes, there's a reason. And if you want to end your suffering, two simple steps. One, call up, make your donation. Two, hop onto my website at awakeningdynamics.com. I host online webinars.
Awesome. Oh, gosh. Can we have you back again?
That would be awesome.
I love it.
Excited
I love it.
To come back.
Thank you so very much. I want to thank, of course, my guest today, Brent Michael Phillips. Check out his website at awakeningdynamics.com and keep those phone lines lit up. It's a beautiful thing to see. Lots of lights lighting up in the phone room. I want to thank Ricky in Master Control. I am Christine Blasdale, and I'm going to go answer some phones. You want to answer some phones, too?
Awesome.
Okay. All right. Stay tuned for more Fund Drive programming coming your way.
The bells of hell go ting-a-ling-a-ling for you, but not for me. Oh, death, where is thy sting-a-ling-a-ling, or grave thy victory?
McDonough John and McCourt Maliki are on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, on Sundays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Topics, wit, wisdom, wackery, sausages. Join us, please!
But not for me. Oh, death, where is thy sting-a-ling-a-ling, or grave thy victory?
This is Christian McBride, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
And similar to what the gent said, yes, indeed, you are tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial radio, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and webcasting at WBAI.org. He didn't say that in that promo, now did he? And no, we're not even thinking about Facebook Live tonight. We are in the new studio, and so far it has been behaving. I hope it will continue to do so. But you know what? Let's start the show proper and play our theme music. So, you know, if you hear me do one of those and this and that, it means I'm trying to figure out the interface here. When let me talk about that for a moment. Last week, I said on the air, you know, after wasting an hour trying to make this room work, after that, I get an email from somebody who thinks they know anything about this radio station. I'll show you how to use it. And I was saying, well, it had something to do with the UX, meaning user experience. This is a conversation all on Facebook in the WBAI radio group, which I'm the admin of. And this person who knows, I think the technical term is bupkis, says, I'll be happy to show you and Max. Like, Max is like the chief not engineer, but along with Michael Haskins and Reggie Johnson, they run the broadcasting of this radio station, right? And this person is going to teach us. And it's like, no, I don't think you understand. Chairs that don't have wheels, when they have wheels and they're on a carpet, which is what's going on this morning, and they don't move. Microphones that obscure your vision of the guests. No visible clocks. Something that's rather useful when you're on the radio is knowing what time it is. It's little things like that. We will get there. We have made quantum leaps, or at least physics leaps, since last week, I'm proud to say. And, ooh, nice windscreen. You see, I didn't pop my P on the word proud. Proud. But also the fact that they gave us directional microphones. So this is me talking directly into the mic. This is me talking to all I did was move my head about 3 inches to the right. Not physically, just turned my head. Because if you have more than one guest, there's one guest over here, one over here, and one over there. But only one of them puts me on mic. That is what we're talking about when we're discussing user experience, says former chief announcer of WBAI. So I just wanted to say, how do I put this politely? Okay. And on that note, and we mean note, what, Max?
That's not visible enough for you behind your back?
No, it's great because it's visible. No. You did that.
I did, and they put one here.
Which I can't see either. Oh, no.
You That's, don't need to see that.
But those weren't there last week, which is what I was referring to.
Look at the size of that thing. Wow.
Okay, and the clock, too.
And the clock, too.
Thank you, Max. I think we better go to the opening of the show, don't you? We're degrading already. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This, on our first, real regular program in about 10 weeks, our guest, I'm proud to say, is Robert Levy. Stay tuned. Thank you.
I'm Dan Persons, and this is my Hour of the Wolf review. Okay, so let's get rid of the bad stuff first. The problem with Missing Link, the stop-motion animated film now available on demand, about an affable and quite talkative Bigfoot who recruits a pair of adventurers to help him get from the forests of Washington State back to his Yeti cousins in the Himalayas, is that it's a pretty accurate showcase for the storytelling flaws we've become accustomed to from its production studio, Laika. There's a tendency to rush through story beats that need to be better laid out. The adventurer, Sir Lionel Frost, voiced by Hugh Jackman, sets forth on his adventure pretty much because a letter sent by the Bigfoot, first named Mr. Link, and later called Susan and voiced by Zach Galifianakis, randomly flaps down on his face, while Frost's former lover, Adelia, voiced by Zoe Saldana, is inexplicably opposed to helping the pair on their mission before she suddenly does a 180 and wants to join the team. Meanwhile, the film's valuable lesson, this is an animated film, there has to be a valuable lesson, that Lionel needs to look beyond the limits of his own ego and be more empathetic, is more described than shown. That may be a flaw in making Lionel the hero of the film. Director and writer Chris Butler wants the man to have his shortcomings while still keeping him pretty endearing. The latter is accomplished. Lionel is quite lovable, but at the expense of the thing that's supposed to show he's learning and growing. So those bumps are there. But you know what? Doesn't really matter. Missing Link is flawed, but it isn't stupid. The tale is a fun little adventure with lots of entertaining characters, lots of swell action, and lots of funny bits. And it is beautiful. Laika may glitch on the story structure, but their animation is pure poetry. With graceful, evocative character acting, every move Lionel makes is wonderful to behold, and ravishing scenery. I'm guessing there's a lot of digital sweetening involved, but if a clip during the credit roll showing the effort involved just in accomplishing a tracking shot of an elephant walking through the jungle is any indication, there's probably less computer intervention than you might expect. As a story, Missing Link is just fine. It doesn't hurt. As a visual experience, as with most of Laika's previous work, it is pure joy. And while we're at it, Gemini Man has also been rushed to the on-demand marketplace, but you don't need to rush to see that. It's a pretty mediocre exercise about an aging assassin played by Will Smith being stalked by his clone, played by a digitally recreated younger Will Smith. In fact, the only reason I'm bringing this up after the fact is that it does have two technical aspects that remain relevant even after the film has faded from memory. One is that digital Will Smith. Everyone involved with the film has been careful to point out that this is not a digitally de-aged Will Smith. That process has well earned all the rebukes it's received, and if the brief clips I've seen of The Irishman are any indication, things haven't gotten much better. But this is a fully digitally generated version, courtesy of Weta Digital, the people previously responsible for Gollum in the Lord of the Rings films, and the apes in the recent Planet of the Apes trilogy. The studio's rep goes unsullied with this film. If I didn't know Digiwill was what boils down to an animated character, I'd be hard-pressed to notice it. The flesh looks real, musculature looks accurate, and most importantly, there's life to those eyes, the hardest thing to achieve when trying to digitally recreate humans. In fact, one of the few clever things director Ang Lee does in the film is progressively troll those in the audience who are just waiting for the effect to slip up. Well, we're only seeing him from a distance. It probably falls apart in close-up. Okay, we've got a good close-up look, but it's in darkness, so it wouldn't be so good in daylight. Okay, so now it's in daylight, and it's still good, but it can't really work across the length of an entire film. Okay, we're spending a good long time with him, but what if he was immersed in mayonnaise, huh? Huh? You didn't think of that one, did you? In fact, the effect is so good that it raises some pointed questions about the current semi-stagnating state of mainstream film. There's already justified concern about the big studios leaning too heavily on comic book movies, sequels, and reboots. What happens when, instead of cultivating new talent whose particular personalities take stories in previously unexplored directions, the studios just cast an electronic Vin Diesel or Matt Damon in their releases? The Pandora's box is open now, and given what we see in Gemini Man, it's not as absurd an idea as it once seemed just a couple of years ago. I'm guessing that eventually this is going to boil down to a test of how much leverage the Screen Actors Guild has in Hollywood. But I'm not betting on the outcome just yet. The other technical innovation in Gemini Man is the use of the high frame rate filming process, otherwise known as HFR, which, depending on the theater you saw it at, ran the film at either 60 frames per second or 120 frames per second. This is, I think, the first time the process is going wide. It was previously used for the Hobbit trilogy and another Ang Lee film, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, which didn't get to many theaters in that format. I was surprised when the theater I work at got it, in fact. The effect here played a lot better than in The Hobbit, I think primarily for the reason that a contemporary setting is more amenable to the crystal clear and somewhat video-ish imagery than the fantasy setting of The Hobbit, where a more burnished look would have worked better. And again, the virtual Will Smith fit right in. I was able to acclimate to the process well enough. But that doesn't mean the process actually enhances the story. There's nothing it adds to the tale beyond everything being sharper. In interview, Ang Lee has said he's fallen in with HFR to give audiences something they can't get on their TV screens. But unlike 3D, I'm thinking HFR's advantages are not immediately clear to anyone who isn't downright geekish about filmmaking. So Will Smith is now as crisp as Andy Cohen. And your point is? We're probably not done with HFR. James Cameron is a huge proponent of the process, so expect whenever we get his Avatar sequels, we'll be watching them that way. But for now, Gemini Man doesn't stand for much more than a preview of two technologies, with the digital humans both intriguing and a little concerning, and the new filming process nifty, but ultimately disposable. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
As always, I will have to get adjusted to them new controls. But regardless of that, thank you, Dan. So, we are still theoretically in a fundraising drive. And normally, actually, I was initially preempted for this week because as our program director, Linda Perry Barr, put it in a memo that she sent out, she would much rather have us, we, WBAI, be the people on the air talking rather than, you heard in the last thing, people saying, oh, we see the phones ringing. There's no phones here. So, was I not supposed to say that? I don't know. But you see, it's pre-recorded. It's not live. We don't have phones here. I started at WBAI answering phones. There are people who are talking about returning to that, but we're losing space in the building that we're in. I think it has something to do with not paying rent. And but we have a very, 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 beneficent landlady. She's really wonderful to us. And she was wonderful to us last night at the New York Review of Science Fiction readings. The space that she runs down there, which this morning's guest was a reader at 2 years ago, year and a half ago. What was it, Robert?
I believe it was 2016.
That long ago.
It was. Time flies.
And it was June, was it not?
It was.
It was Gay month, Pride month.
Yes, I read with Roz Cavani.
Oh, that's right.
Which is really special.
Every time she comes to the U.S., I grab her. She is great.
That was really fantastic.
And the thing is that I almost specifically tried not to have a gay-themed thing that much, for a very good reason. It's like, you know, why shouldn't we have Christmas the whole year round? Why can't we have gay-themed things all the time? Why, you know, do I only have black people on Black History Month?
Well, you know what, Jim? I'm gay and it's December, so there you go. You're having me on. It's not Gay Pride Month.
Yeah, well, no, I know. I'm just saying it was... Because I think it was Roz or it was you. Somebody said, I'm so glad that you're celebrating Gay Pride. And I'm thinking, no, we're always doing that. Yeah. You know, every time we have Sam Miller or Rick Bowes or, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, we're gay year-round and we're happy when you have us. Anytime you have us, so.
And I maintain that all of the science fiction that we have on the air is queer.
Yes, well, I mean...
Well, it used to be called, you know, weird or queer. They sure. were the same. They were synonyms.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a whole strain of horror that is basically just called weird fiction now. And
always weird tales goes back
absolutely.
To the
30s. I mean, and Jeff Vandermeer, who's like a sort of, you know, exemplar of that medium is, you know, that's it's weird. We like to make things weird.
Oh, there's
weird.
Ted White before him, and he's still around. He sure. was the editor of Weird Tales 40 years before Jeff. And Ted's still with us.
Yeah, okay, good.
One of Barbara's first sales, my partner Barbara Krasnoff, one of her first sales
love Barbara.
Was in Weird Tales. Her first was Amazing Stories.
And, you know, it, Weird Tales, I love Weird Tales. I think they've relaunched now, which is really amazing.
They die, they come back, they die again, yeah. they come back yeah. again.
I mean, it's fitting. you can't keep a weird tale down.
No, I guess not. So anyhow, as I was saying, we were theoretically preempted for this week, yeah. but Robert was actually supposed to be my guest. Like the very week that the bad guys.
Yes.
Yeah, for people who don't understand the politics at BAI, it's very simple. There's two organizations. One is called the Good Guys, and the other one is called the Bad Guys. We here now are the Good Guys. And the people who came in to shut us down were the Bad Guys. So the Bad Guys came in to shut us down. Robert was supposed to have been the guest that week. And I felt awful because I've been inviting him for those two-something years to be on the show live. And he emailed me and said, I finally have something I want to promote. And so we had set up that date, sort of in congruence with a publication from Lethe Press. Yes, Lethe Press. I had to check my pronunciation, but I actually checked that again with Steve Berman, the publisher.
Well done.
I had a piece on Lightspeed magazine of somebody who had something published in Lethe Press, and I just wanted to be very sure that I had the name right. I have a lot of friends who've published in Lethe Press.
I'm impressed that you didn't have to ask me that my last name was Levy because, you know, three times out of four people say Levy, which is fine. I don't
– Goyim.
But, yeah. Well, I, you know. Goyim. Well done, Jeb. You didn't have to ask. It was Levy.
I just watched an episode of season three of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel last night. So I've got all the Jewish talk from my DNA coming out.
Well done, but Eugene Levy of Schitt's Creek is a Levy, so
that's true.
You never know, but I am a Levy, so and you didn't have
although,
to ask.
Although I,
you're
I,
right,
but also he's Canadian.
Oh, okay. Well, then
yeah, one has to take that into account.
Jewish Canadians. I mean, there's, I don't
but
even
any,
know.
Oh God, that was a novelist.
What?
Who wrote specifically Jewish Canadian? Fiction.
Oh, sure. It was
great novelist and short story.
It was
writer. Mark something. No.
Dirty Kravitz.
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It he was, wrote The Apprenticeship of Dirty Kravitz.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Amazing writer. I'm blanking on his name.
Now I've got to Google.
Yeah. He used to write, like, Montreal Jews.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he seemed to have disappeared.
I'm not going to try to...
I have to type it.
Well...
Now, see, this is what happens. Yeah. I was talking about... My head isn't that far away from where it was, people. But all I have to do is look at the computer, which I need to access.
We all need the computer. He died in, like, the past 10 years or so.
Yeah.
But my dad was a big fan of his.
As was I.
Here Jim goes. He's doing it.
I wrote Dudley instead.
it'll come up.
Yeah. So it tells me about Richard Dreyfuss,
right? Who's in the movie?
Yes, but let's. But I'm talking about the book people. Mordechai Richler.
Thank you.
Okay, I knew it started with an M. Mordechai Richler. There's no H in there, but I say Chai.
Well done.
So, hi, everybody. Good morning.
Hi.
So, you know, one of the comments that our program director told me about my show, as we get the ball rolling, is that I spend too much time foomfering around in the beginning of the show, and it's already 1:24 in New York, and she says, get right to it, Jim. Have some of the meaty meal of the show near the top. So you said you had a few things you wanted to read this morning?
I'm willing to read all sorts of things, but the one thing I wanted to read, because I have a new novella out, is a piece of my novella,
Usually novellas, by the way, are not until maybe 5 or 6 years ago, you would not find a novella between book covers. It would be within an anthology or a collection.
Absolutely. But
the market has happily changed.
Yeah, and people are really coming around to that form. One thing that is interesting about novellas, specifically in terms of horror, and this novella, I consider it a horror novella, but there are all sorts of
for those people we were talking about Weird Tales, the inside cover looks very much like Hannes Bach.
Yes.
from the pulp magazine.
Yeah, it's the spirit of the novella, which is called Anais Nin at the Grand Guignol.
You say not, is that the proper? Well, I always said Anais.
I mean, I've always said Anais Nin.
I may look it up. In the 70s, we broadcast the Anais or Anais Nin Diaries on this, the whole thing.
That's what this is all about. On yeah. This,
yeah.
And it's, I come by my whole experience with Anais Nin, or however it is correctly pronounced. I'm not a fluent French speaker, although I do speak a little French. But
no, but I've got Google. While you're reading, I'm going to use that.
That's how I've always pronounced it, but I'm open to being corrected. She was and is a legendary sort of figure in feminist writing and in erotic writing, and has been a big part of people's sexual awakenings, whether, you know, mostly women, but also people of all stripes, that she really invented a certain kind of writing about particularly sexuality that I think exists to this day, and is really sort of, you know, at the same time that she's sort of sui generis, she's opened the door for so many people, and that was one of the reasons why I wanted to write something about her and try to wear her voice, which is what this is.
And explain to people then also, what is the Grand Guignol?
So the Grand Guignol is a form,
a theater form.
Yeah, it was an actual theater called the Théâtre du Grand Guignol in Paris that spread other places, but primarily it was known for being in Paris. It began in 1890 and went all the way through the 1950s, and it was a theater where weird stuff was exhibited on stage that people came to see to sort of live out these weird, somewhat perverse fantasies.
Sometimes very bloody.
Very frequently bloody. It was known as a theater of spectacle, primarily for horror, but also for sex. And they had a kind of signature delivery of one act experiences that you would arrive for. Over the course of the evening, you would see, it was called Un Douche Écossaise, which translates to hot and cold shower. So they would give you a hot and cold shower. They give you an experience of sex, something maybe a light sexual display on stage that was it was scripted. It
wasn't free form and
it
wasn't two people.
It was part of a scenario.
Yeah. The two people would know exactly, or if it's more than two, would know exactly.
It was completely staged. It wasn't like going to a strip club. It was very, very staged. And then they would have something, that was much more dark. That was either something that was social commentary or was something very or something very horrific, where they would have something about either police corruption or a mad scientist.
Sweeney Todd has been described as a modern grand – I've always said Guignol. I could be wrong about that. It doesn't have the sex – despite the Sondheim, but
right.
but it certainly has. I've seen. It's an amazingly brilliant bloody production. What they did was they had the Sweeney Michael Cerveris in that production. You would have the person in the barber chair whose throat would be slit on the far end of the stage. And Sweeney on the opposite end of the stage. And he would move his razor 20 feet away from the person, but you would see the appearance of the person's throat being cut, even though there was nobody near him and the blood running down. It was, and I'm an anti-gore person, but this was just, it was so artistic. The gore was so ingenious because there was nobody committing the act, or rather the person committing the act was nowhere near the person to whom it was occurring. So it was quasi-magical, totally theatrical.
All of that.
But it didn't have Angela Lansbury. So.
All of that, that was Patti LuPone, maybe.
I saw her substitute. I saw it with Judy Kaye, who was filling in for LuPone. And I have seen LuPone on screen doing Mrs. Lovett. And she is not near my top Mrs. Lovett's. Number one will always be...
Angela Lansbury.
Angela Lansbury.
Understood.
Number two is Emma Thompson.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I didn't know she did it.
She only did four performances.
Oh, my goodness.
At the New York Philharmonic, and Sweeney was Bryn Terfel.
Wow. Okay.
And this was on PBS, but I lucked out. I found out about it 2 days in advance. I bought tickets and got in great seats. Sondheim in the audience, the whole nine wow. yards. And I can't... Okay, I'll take 1 minute to describe. They come out as if it's going to be a concert. Singing, you know, the kind of thing. Everybody has a music stand in front of them. Everybody in tuxedos. Emma Thompson's gown is gorgeous and all that. They come out. There's applause. And one person looks at the other. And Bryn Terfel sneers. Like, only Bryn Terfel can sneer. Big Welshman. And he just, like, takes his music and throws it away. And Emma Thompson knocks her music stand over. And then somebody else knocks their thing over. And all of a sudden, all the principals are running all over the theater. They take the piano and turn it upside down, and it turns into a barber chair.
Oh, wow.
And all this. And within the space of about 60 seconds, you have a fully staged Sweeney Todd with the entire New York Philharmonic, the greatest tenor in the world singing, and Emma Thompson, who started in musical theater for... Her first major show was Me and My Girl. It's amazing production and occasionally broadcast on PBS. I urge people to see it. Now, there is one that I'm willing to believe, one Mrs. Lovett, who might be better, but I've never seen it, although I understand it's been filmed, and that's Imelda Staunton, who is the best Mama Rose I've ever seen in Gypsy. Huh. She, you know, people say, oh, you mean the woman from Harry Potter? Yes, the woman from Harry Potter. Forget that, please. This is one of the great actresses of the 20th and 21st centuries. And she's quite amazing. So I'd love to see her take on it.
Yeah, I mean, Sweeney Todd is very much in the grand game.
But I'm willing
spirit.
To give Lupone a chance in the upcoming production of Company. Because I have heard the British production in which she plays the Elaine Stritch role.
I saw her not in the all female version, but I've already seen her in Company do the Stritch.
The ladies lunch. She's gotten
before.
That was the same. Yep. That was at Lincoln Center.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
That was the same director as the Sweeney that I saw, and I thought that she was adequate. I'm not a Lupone fan. I will
tragically admit that I'm not a Lupone, that big. She.
I know I'm going against the tide.
I know, and I, you know, she. She's a legend. Her voice is insane. She has a problem with character for me. She doesn't She doesn't actually do character,
which is all that Mrs. Lovett is about.
Yeah, she doesn't. That's her.
And at least in Company, character. You know, she only has to have that character.
It's not much.
For
you
one
don't have
song.
To do much. Yeah,
but
absolutely.
You have to do it. But on the album of Company, the London cast. Now you know about this production, right?
Sure.
Okay, because this isn't on. This is coming to Broadway in like April.
You mean the all female version?
Well, no, not
oh.
all female. Bobby is a
oh,
female.
Okay. Oh, I thought it was all female.
No, she has boyfriends.
Okay.
The Bobby and Company, the original Company, is a bachelor with girlfriends everywhere. This is a woman with boyfriends everywhere.
Okay. All right.
But the two couple getting married, not getting married today, two gay men, which works perfect because you can't change the lyric. Somebody tell Paul I'm not getting married today.
Right.
Doesn't change. But Barcelona, it's gender switch. It's a lot of gender switching, and it all works. But it's but the Elaine Stritch role is now Patti LuPone. She did it in London, and she's coming to Broadway with it. And I have to say, you know, with my arms crossed saying, oh, she is going to screw this up like she did the Lincoln Center. And I listened to the album, and I thought, ooh, she was good.
Okay, good.
She was good. So I'm, yeah, well, in that role, in that performance. Yeah.
And she can be a little extra in a way that is not necessarily serving the story. Let's put it that way.
Shall we say once again, Gypsy?
Yeah, I saw her in Gypsy on Broadway, and it was very not necessarily serving the story.
Exactly. Yeah. Because, in my opinion, LuPone is largely about LuPone.
Yeah.
But she's a fascinating woman.
Yeah, I never saw
I saw her in her first role.
Yes,
A Day at Hollywood, A Night at the Ukraine. Two one-act shows. The second part was a Marx Brothers riff. That's why Day in Hollywood, Night at the Ukraine, Day of the Races, blah, blah, blah. She was Harpo. And she was great. She was wonderful, and that was 40 years ago.
I've always I'm a big Evita fan.
That's her first big role.
Yeah, right? I mean, but she never brought any nuance to that. You know, it was sort of like it was all sort of, you know.
Funny, that's what Andrew Lloyd Webber said.
Yeah, it's accurate. I mean, it's the truth.
Sorry. Yeah. Well, I mean, her relationship with directors, Arthur Lawrence, who had to be coerced by his dying husband into directing LuPone in Gypsy, or Harold Prince. She said in a recent New York Times article that he bullied her. That, you know, he was the kind of person who would just choose one person, a major person in the cast, and say, you don't know how to act. You don't know how to do this and that. And so she never worked with him again, which is why she didn't. Now, she worships Sondheim, and in that she and I belong to the same religion. But she that kept her out of a lot of Sondheim shows because Harold Prince directed the majority of those. On the other hand, when you listen to her story, as to why, you sympathize. So it's not like this horrible woman. No, it's just too often I've seen her on stage and it ends up being about her and not about the role.
Yeah.
As you say, the character.
And I mean,
and therefore the show.
Yeah, it's as I think so many times you have, I feel like there's a wall between the talent and the writers in a lot of these situations where they don't feel like they can. It's funny because I read it's probably the same profile. I don't know if it's the same profile you read.
It was about 2 months ago.
In the Times?
Yeah.
Well, and she,
I was fascinated by it.
The Patti LuPone profile. She,
I was there to hate it, and I ended up loving her.
Yeah, and no, I've always loved her. I've always felt for her.
The majority of people love her.
So she, and the interviewer in this profile said, the interviewer asked, "I've never understood why, in Evita, why Ava sings, 'Don't cry for me, Argentina.'
When she's at the height of her glory.
And Patti says, I don't understand. I didn't understand that either. Why are they weeping for her at this big moment? But what was bizarre to me is that neither the interviewer or indeed Patti LuPone did not understand that the word cry in Don't Cry for Me, Argentina, the way that it is written, is it means don't cheer for me. The word is the word cry.
A great cry
is don't cry for me. I don't cheer for me.
Because in fact, the setting of that song,
she's actually saying don't cheer for me. It's when she's become the first lady, and neither the interviewer nor Patti LuPone herself understood the Tim Rice's lyric that he actually means don't cheer for me. I'm just like you. And lo and behold, 40 years after her signature role, she didn't understand that the lyric actually means don't cheer for me.
Okay, but you know what?
Not don't weep for me.
That is okay. In her defense, that's not her fault. You have a director. You have a song. You have a lyricist. You have all these people in a huge production where, you know, Mandy Patinkin and all these people are working on this thing, doing rehearsals and all that, and nobody bothered to explain that?
I can understand it in the moment, but to not – when you've been doing it for 40 years – that's when you know, I mean, that made me think a bit about, you know, like,
where her head is at.
I mean, yeah, like, because they discuss it in the article. They're like, why are they saying don't weep for me, basically?
Yeah.
Like, that's actually not what the lyric means.
Yeah.
It's don't cheer for me.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but you see, in her defense, all I'll say is, actors don't do their stuff on their own. They're not just a collective, except in certain special productions. You have a director, in that case, one of the big name directors. You have the composer and lyricist is in the theater. You have producers. Lord knows how many producers. And I think that's a Harold Prince show, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's probably the one where he bullied her. Yeah. Using her term.
I believe it. And she didn't originate the role. It was it Eileen Page or
Elaine Page in London.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
but the broad. So, but in New York. In New York, when you do the role in New York, yes, you originate the role.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. But there might not have been a lot of time to ask questions, certainly. But you're in
rehearsal for 3 months, folks, and then the show runs, and then you still have a stage manager to ask questions from,
yeah,
and blah blah blah. I've worked in theater. I've had a very short life on Broadway, which I don't discuss on the air. I don't, but I'll tell you off the air. But I've been in I've worked on 3 shows. Both of them were off Broadway, all of them. One of them went further, but you got plenty of time and plenty of resources that you can turn to. This is not getting your story read on the air.
Yeah, I mean,
which I promised I would turn over a new leaf and
You did promise, Jim. You promised that your manager, right?
I promised our program director, exactly. For a very weird reason. She said that, I mean, we don't really follow ratings much, but she said that my ratings went up in the second hour.
Interesting.
And I said, "What?" And she said, "What are you doing in that first hour?" I said, "Oh, I'm introducing the writer. I'm talking, schmoozing, like we're doing stuff like that." And then in the second hour is when the writer starts to read. And she said, "That's it. Get the writer to read at the top of the show."
Well,
and I'm sorry, Linda, but you know how many 40 plus years of Hour of the Wolf.
I would like to say to Linda and to you, Jim, that this is all related because this my novella that I'm reading from is about theater. It's about theatricality. This is all actually relevant.
But I'm going to take her part in this also because I do have to, you know, old dog, new tricks. I do have to learn them. And one of the things is that that should be the discussion that follows the reading. She wants the main course up front, and after that, you have a nice side dish and a salad. That metaphor just does not work. Does not work at all. Do you feel ready to read, or do you want to hear some music first, and then we'll...
Whatever you want, Jim. I'm ready to...
You're the one who's going to read.
I'd be happy to read now.
Okay.
Sure.
Let us have that.
So I guess I should probably give a little prelude to this.
Yeah. I do need to do a promo, but you know...
Okay.
I'm going whenever you're ready. I'll do it after you read.
Okay.
But everybody listening, be aware that you're busy on Saturday. You're coming to 388 Atlantic Avenue in order to see a new film series of short subjects. And I'll tell you more about it later.
So
a teaser for
well
a promo.
Ten. So I'm reading from my novella Anais Nin at the Grand Guignol, and it is unsurprisingly about Anais Nin at the Grand Guignol, and a little word about that is, so if you don't know who Anais Nin is, she's a sort of iconic feminist author who's known for her legendary diaries, and this is written in the form of her diaries. It's kind of a lost diary that takes place after – it's kind of slotted in, if you know her, if you don't, after the diaries that are collected in the volume Henry in June, and that's about her – affair, her love triangle with the author Henry Miller and his wife June Miller, and it was made into a movie that came out in 1990 by
according to Google, Anais.
All right, me and Google will have words later, I guess.
it's the woman who did the audiobook.
All right.
I just heard her say it. Whatever.
All right. I'm sticking with Anais. She is a very bourgeois banker's wife in Paris in 1933. Who is also has this very bohemian life on the side with writers like Henry Miller and later Antonin Artaud and all these other luminaries that at this point are starving artists who are completely unpublished, completely unknown to anyone. And she herself is a great artist that is not even recognized in any way, shape, or form, completely unpublished. And it turns out today she's, as I said, mostly known for her explicit and honest diaries. And this is about half Anais Nin and half the Grand Guignol. And the Grand Guignol is this legendary theater of virtue and vice, if you will. So this piece of the novella that I'm going to read is about her first going home with the Grand Dame of the Grand Guignol, a woman named Paula Maxa, who is also a real person. These are, by and large, all historical figures. And Paula Maxa is known for being a very outlandish figure. And this is their first real encounter after Anais has gone to the Grand Guignol numerous times and experienced some very strange moments where Maxa has seemed like she's had otherworldly powers and charms that have affected Anais personally while she has been in the audience of the Grand Guignol. So she goes home one night with Maxa after a performance at the Grand Guignol. And again, this is written in the style of Anais's own diary. So it is from her point of view. Her apartment is only a few blocks from the theater, and we walk at a brisk pace. Moxa often looks over her shoulder or stops to peer into the faces of passing strangers, as if she's attempting to glean some hidden meaning from their features. We soon reach her building, the last of a succession of severe tenements, and climb the stairs to her top floor flat. Once inside, I take in the dark living space, an eerie reflection of the guignol's sensual morbidity. Black velvet draped in heavy folds along the walls and ceiling, all the upholstery blood red, from the tattered divans to the throw pillows atop rugs and teetering piles, elaborate oversized candelabras, whose immense pillar candles max the lights one after the next, dried wax suspended in hardened pools along the scored wooden floorboards. She pours us two tumblers of pastis, kicks off her boots, and drops down onto one of the couches. "Sit, please." She hands me a glass, and I lower myself across from her, nestling upon a pillow beside the tiled hexagonal table at the center of the room. She gulps at her drink, lights a little brass lamp, and fishes a strangely shaped pipe from among the unseemly items splayed across the table. "Would you like to smoke opium with me?" I never have before." Then pay close attention." I watch fascinated as she leans over the lamp and inhales the dark brown tar, sweet blue smoke emerging from her lips, and floating upwards, restless spirits made visible. Her eyes close in rapt pleasure, and I feel that I have become vestigial, someone who has seen her safely home to her sheltering arms of her true lover, one capable of meeting all her needs. I take the lamp from her and inhale, the smoke floral and spiced as it invades my lungs. I hold it in, then exhale in a wide arc. "And now you have smoked opium," she says. "I did warn that you were crossing a threshold." She sighs, her heavy eyelids drooping upon their beds of powder and coal. "You asked me to tell you how I was able to access your mind, to commingle our essences on the boards at the Grignol. You asked how it was possible to see out from the eyes of another. But in doing so, you ask the wrong questions. If you really want to know how I am gifted with such talents, then you must learn how it is that I reach this twilight pass." Maxa pours herself another pastis, the glass clouded the way her eyes are clouded, murky and unforthcoming. "In more than 15 years at the Grignol, I have died thousands of deaths upon its stage. I have been stabbed, strangled, poisoned, hanged, scalped, burned alive, buried alive, and more. An impressive achievement as far as such things go, no one can deny that fact. And believe me when I say that each death has been felt deep inside me. Every one of them. From the first to the last." She sets the opium alight, draws in the thin line of smoke, and hands me the pipe so that I might do the same. This time, I become lightheaded and try not to cough as I exhale. "These little deaths, they take their toll," she says. "Upon my body and my mind, my very soul. No part of me left untouched or uncorrupted, nothing left of me pure. So it is that in turn, I myself have killed, murdered, as I have been murdered, for lust, for revenge, in defense of my womanhood, varying forms of rightness or injustice, meted out however the Guignol playwrights see fit. These killings do their own type of damage, and I dwell in a dual darkness of my own making, trapped in a tangled web of violence as both spider and prey. In doing so, I have become the very bride of death itself. There is no escape, not any longer. She casts her eyes about the room, as if seeing it for the first time. The mutable shadows and flickering candle flames, the dense fabrics womb-like and suffocating, all of it a haze through the dense scrim of smoke. "This apartment was once my safe haven," she whispers. "It was filled with sunlight, with laughter, with the sweet smell of fresh flowers threaded through the air, a home suffused with hope. But then a man came along, and he changed everything. He led me away from the sun, and soon all my hope was gone." Maxa shrugs. "These days, I am a reflection of the world itself, from which hope fast departs, just the same. You feel it as well, do you not? The entire globe will be drenched in blood soon enough." "Surely you can find your way out of this," I say, taken aback by the unending depths of her despair. "Surely there are other theaters who would consider themselves lucky to have an actress of your obvious abilities. Or there are other lines of work to pursue. You don't need to be tied to the Guignol and its perverse charms. It is not as if you were some kind of indentured servant." "But that is exactly what I am." She smiles, though there is no joy in it. "Only it is not to the Guignol that I am enslaved." Maxa lights a cigarette before her eyes settle on mine once more. "There is a man who walks these streets, the one who stole me away from the light and brought me into darkness. A most dangerous man, cruel and unyielding. He wears black from head to toe so that he may go unnoticed until it is time for him to reveal his true face. He goes by many names, and also by no name at all. To some, he is the dark angel of music, whereas to others, he is known as Courcelle, Lord of the Great Deep. But I know him as Monsieur Guillard." She glances behind me into the heavy velvet folds draping the walls, as if expecting to see someone there. "I called upon him once, when I was younger and restless, and he came to me as a midnight lover arrives. With a snap of his fingers, he made all my troubles vanish, my profound pain, my loneliness, my hunger. All of it was lifted from me in a whirlwind of lightning and rain. I never felt so happy, not in all my life. I became Maxa, high priestess of sin and horror, the crown princess of blood." I'd found my purpose at last, and my ascent at the Guignol soon followed. As my talents blossomed, I grew capable of casting glamours and charms, like the fairies of legend. I learned to make my face beautiful one instant, and hideous the next. I could even cast a spell to cause a crowd to feel what I felt in that very moment, to look out from behind my eyes, draw on the audience's hidden fantasies and perversions, to make each role a revelation, both personal and profound. That is how I witnessed my friend in you the other night, she nods. Another gift from the Dark Angel. That is how tonight, during La Famille de Péché, that I saw my own... I do not say more, though she must already know what dark thoughts stir inside me, what forbidden passions loom behind my mask of propriety. She must know me now. At first, it felt as if they were gifts given freely, Maxa says. It was a golden time, one in which I made my own name and was freed at last from the shackles of my childhood and the rest of my unhappy past. Then one gloomy spring night, not so very long ago, a night very much like this, Godfather Death finally showed me his true face. I had almost forgotten about him, which made it all the worse when he darkened my door once more. He came to collect his payment, and I could not refuse. Now, I fear I do not have much time left at all. That is the nature of such bargains, I'm afraid. What do you owe this man? I say. Perhaps I can secure you the necessary funds to ease your debt. Money, she chuckles, her eyes receding into her skulls as she slides further into the opium's poppy embrace. You do not understand. He has no interest in such concerns. She holds her cigarette to her lips, the smoke bisecting her face. He only desires flesh, in all its many forms. He is the demon lover, and what isn't given to him freely will be taken by force. I attempt to appease him, to sate him the very best that I can. She glances at the pipe upon the table. Still, it is never enough. A firm rap jolts the apartment door. Once, twice, three times, and her face goes ashen pale. No, she whispers. Jesus in heaven, no. What is it? Is it him? Not tonight. Please, not tonight. She rises from the couch and stumbles over the corner of the table as she falls moaning to the carpet. Please, no, not now, not now. I will protect you. I help her back to her feet, my mind soupy and swimming with the drug. I will not let you bring any harm. There's no protecting me from him. Not now, and not ever. Another three knocks, louder this time, more insistent, with the fraught menace heralding the arrival of a villain from the wings. And how we seem to have found ourselves cast in just such a scenario, as if written for the Guignol stage itself. Whether I prove heroine or victim, it is still too soon to tell.
When I look out my window, many sights to see. And when I look in my window, so many different people to be. They're strange, so strange. It's very strange to me. You got to pick up every stitch. You got to pick up every stitch. You got to pick up every stitch. Oh no, must be the season.
Actually, it's the Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York, and you've been listening to Robert Levy reading from his novella, Aeneas Nin at the Grand Guignol.
What do you think I see? Some other cat looking over, over his shoulder. And he's straight. Very strange to me. You've got to pick up every stitch. You've got to pick up every stitch. Beatniks are out to make it rich. Oh no, must be the season of the witch. Must be the season.
And you are tuned. What a lovely version. I've never heard that one before. Lana Del Rey from the motion picture Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, which Robert Levy, our guest this morning, requested. And I'm so glad because I have always loved that song.
It's a great song.
It is. It is. And generally, I'm not big on a lot of covers, but for some reason, well, number one, Donovan does brilliant versions of his own stuff. And there are some people like Bruce Springsteen and all that where the cover is better. You know, Dylan, even Phil Oakes, you know, few people, often the covers are better.
Sure.
Occasionally, Joni Mitchell. Although, you know, how can you fault Joni Mitchell? But still, you know, a legitimate cover. But Donovan, you know, his version of Sonny Good Street cannot be improved upon. But that was just a lovely
I'm so glad you liked it.
I really
like
did.
It too a lot.
And it fit the story.
Thanks.
It really did. Wow, what a lovely, creepy little. So would you consider that to be spec fic or not? Not that it matters. It doesn't need to fill that niche for me.
The novella. The novella is totally spec fic.
Okay.
Well, yeah.
I haven't read it. I'm sorry to say.
That's okay. You've been busy, Jim.
I've been busy. And also, my house has been in total disarray. And only this last weekend, I was going through huge piles of books. And I thought, oh, my, thank God I found your book.
Thanks for bringing it.
Just in time. And then Barbara tried to snatch it because she wants to read it. And it's like, nope, me first. You've got a pile of my books next to you. I've stolen all the movies you've been getting for screeners. So, you know, we're equitable on that.
So this was, you know, again, you know, it's called Uneasden at the Grand Guignol, and this was the
let's spell it for people, okay? Because okay. However we're pronouncing it,
Aniesnin at the Grand Guignol.
Right.
Yeah, it's a lot.
Because it just occurred to me that, you know, hey, it's radio.
Yeah. So the pitch.
Oh, and it's from Lethe Press.
Lethe
Press. Lethe.
Yes.
And Steve wrote me that it rhymes with jetty.
Jetty. Okay. Good to know.
So Lethe Press.
So the
Steve Berman is the editor publisher.
Yes. Extraordinaire. The mission statement and the plot is all in the title, which is Aniesnin and the Grand Guignol. And this was the elevator pitch
is built into the title.
Yeah, it was my way of bringing together this erotic literary feminist energy with this dark, dark kind of shocking energy, which fits very well in Aniesnin or Aniesnin or however.
I will continue.
Even
though it's a real person.
I'll just stick with Anies.
Fine.
For me, it felt like a natural fit, and a lot of her erotica is very dark, very graphic, very and with a lot of demon lover energy, which is really that's really what the piece is about. It's about a demon lover.
Yeah, but we were invoking drugs in there, which could possibly say, well, was it a demon lover?
Yeah, this is very early in the story. And yeah, I mean, things go down.
I'm not touching the polite way to say it. Okay, yes.
And it's about, but ultimately it's about a woman who is in the middle of her life and is in a very comfortable marriage and is very unhappy. And it's about a woman that needs to be shocked back to life. And Aniesnin is known traditionally as an author that is very much about embracing life, and she's the kind of author that you see people post Instagram quotes from.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you know, a pejorative way to put it is very like live, laugh, love kind of energy, but that's not really what she was about. She was actually a woman that was very lost and often depressed but she always searched for meaning and truth and for something larger than herself. And she is the ultimate, Emily Dickinson aside, she's the ultimate feminist author who no one had 1,000 doors slammed in her face. And it turned out that what she landed up being recognized for better ill, and that's a whole other conversation, which is for her diaries and her own life, which she mined very, very heavily for her fiction as well. But she landed up becoming an icon for the stories that she told about her life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's it's very interesting because back then, certainly in the 30s, were just sort of considered the time that – I mean, she didn't – no one knew who she was until at least the 50s.
This is post-Salon, really, right? Or is it during the Salon era?
Yeah, it's
– Would I see her in Midnight in Paris?
That's the 20s, yes, but she was – They weren't part of the fabulous crowd like Hemingway and Gertrude Stein. They were not fabulous. You know, they were the dirt poor. I mean, she was bourgeois, but people like Henry Miller were like, I mean,
yeah.
had nothing. They weren't part of that crowd that was the sort of like, certainly not any sort of glittering, you know, nothing attached to, you know, Hemingway or Fitzgerald or any of that sort of era. It was a little bit later that they were writing things that were much more raw and dirty and banned for many years in a lot of countries. Mm-hmm. Certainly, no one published her. Forget about her. But Henry Miller got banned for decades.
Yeah.
And she was
Henry Miller made it to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's not Hemingway.
That's the WBAI, so we're a kindred spirit. Well, we did. The Carlin case, that's us.
Yeah. I mean, this is it was a different era, and I mean, certainly it's funny because I became aware of Anna Eastman because of the movie Henry and June that came out in 1990, which I saw when I was 15 or so. And it was a big part of my awakening as not only in so many ways, sexually, as an artist, in all sorts of ways. And I know a lot of people felt similarly. And I found out that the world's leading Anna Eastman expert now is had the same experience. He'd never heard of her until that movie came out. So lo and behold, and it's a good movie.
Well, I'll claim they all learned it from WBAI.
Yes.
Because we broadcast the diary.
I love it.
In the middle of the afternoon, as I recall, that was before the Carlin case.
It's good stuff.
It is.
It is really good stuff.
Yeah. I remember engineering segments. I wasn't a reader or anything, but the best job at WBAI is being an engineer.
Is it?
It is, because you get to sit in this room or the previous versions of this room and watch the most fascinating people in the world who are guests on other people's shows come in and go out. So, you know, I always thought that I should just have an autograph book of people who I've engineered. You know, I would have Miles Davis and...
Wow.
You know, just so many amazing people. And, you know, worked with Abbie Hoffman and William Buckley and, you know, all these folk who have passed through here. Amazing people. Carlin, of course. And, well, before my time, Hugh Downs. But he was chief announcer. Hugh Downs, right. For those who remember who Hugh Downs was.
Sure.
And all that. So being the engineer, the person who sits here during the day, like Max Schmid does in evenings, or Michael G. Haskin does during the daytimes, with all the different fascinating people that have radio shows, and they're pretty fascinating for the most part to begin with, and then they bring their contacts and all that in. The people who Leonard Lopate has on his show every day of the week, just, you know, those people alone are. So I wanted to keep an autograph book, but I never did that, darn it. I have a few photos, at least.
I mean, but you know, you're a treasure trove of that knowledge.
I'm a treasure trove of trivia, to be alliterative about it.
I can only aspire, you know. I mean, if you want to talk.
But you see, the thing is that, yes, it's possible to do what I do and what I have done, but it's unpaid work. And, you know, you put all the time that I've put into it, and you end up not making a living.
Sure.
And that is a consideration, which is why we ask listeners to become members of WBAI.
Sounds
by
like
going
a good
to
idea.
WBAI.org. And I recommend BAI Buddy, which is sort of like being it's sort of like Patreon. But for WBAI, you pledge a certain amount a month, and then we get our hooks into you. But it's great for us because it assures us a future budget. It's not just like a donation then and there. But if you want to do that, you can also do that at WBAI.org right now, in fact. I would tell you the phone number, but hey, guess what? In the new studio, we don't have the phone numbers. In fact, if I was to ask people to call on the air right now, which I would do, I don't know the number. Max, if you can hear me, if you're listening to air, fat chance, could you bring that in? Could you give me the phone number that people are supposed to call? Or if listeners who already know that number, see, it changes a lot.
Henry Miller would have never become a published author if it wasn't for Anais Nin's patronage. So if you have
any... And we are
any,
getting calls, by the way.
If you have any money to give to WBAI, like Anais gave to Henry Miller, just for a little tie-in there,
yes, and
I highly recommend it.
And you can say that you're going to dedicate that donation to Anais Nin, or
I like
pronounce
that.
It as
yeah.
you will.
But
unfortunately, the call went away. It was just the one. But I'll get out the phone number. If you want to talk for 30 seconds nonstop, I can run out, get the phone number.
I'm going to talk while Jim.
Okay,
yeah, so,
You do that.
So one of the tensions in Anais Nin's life is between her bourgeois and bohemian existences. Her husband, Hugh, who is a banker, an American banker, who moved with her back to France. She was a Cuban-French woman who lived in New York and then moved back to France. She was able to support a number of amazing artists because of her husband. He supported her career, but she in turn supported people like Henry Miller and other people like Antonin Artaud. And, it was a time just like our time now in this country where the arts are not properly supported. So we need people to pitch in, just like WBAI needs people to pitch in.
It does. And the telephone number to... No, we got the call-in number. But people know the pledge. You know what? Don't worry about the pledge number. Just use your browser. Go to WBAI.org. And believe me, it will start soliciting you. And then you will comply. If you would like to call in and speak with Robert Levy about his work, the telephone number here at WBAI to call in the air is 212-209-2877. 212-209-2877. And you see, and just to make things complicated, they have two different call-in lines. I'm only giving the one. You know, why do we have two separate lines for that? And then yet a third line for people to pledge, which is why I just give the website information. If you had to describe yourself as a writer to people, which of course you do, how would you typify yourself?
That is a very good question. I mean, the simple answer is that I consider myself a cross-genre writer, although the complicated answer is that not many people necessarily know what that means, and I'm happy to be called a horror writer, a fantasy writer, a science fiction writer, a speculative fiction writer.
All of the above.
It's not a literary fiction writer, a thriller. But the truth of the matter is, I sit down and I write lands up touching upon a number of different of these modes, and I've sat down to write things that were strictly horror or strictly mm-hmm. fantasy, and I just can't do it. I'm a little bit all over the place in terms of genre. But it turns out that I like things that don't fit a particular mode. It's my favorite kind of thing to read. I love my favorite writers are people like Elizabeth Hand and, you know, I love all sorts of people.
What I call spec fic. Jim.
Yes, absolutely spec fic.
I don't want to pin her down.
But my favorite things that I read are things where, you know, there's another writer, Dan Shaun. I don't know if you know him.
No.
He's considered literary. It's Dan, C-H-A-O-N, but it's pronounced Shaun.
Okay.
Where he's considered a literary writer. And then, you know. But it's thriller mixed with horror, mixed with, you know, literary. It's you don't know what you're going to get. And that I love not knowing what you're going to get when you pick something up.
Mm-hmm.
That's just what I love, where anything can come into it.
Yeah.
And that's what I like to read. And I think it turns out that that's what I write as well, where you don't know what's going to happen, what's behind the next corner.
Okay. Now, when you write, do you have an object in mind as the work is progressing? For example, with this, I mean, obviously this is a highly structured work because it begins with, you know, the unfolding of a veil, and then after a while, more can be seen behind the veil.
Right.
So do you know how the story is going, or the work, because you're working on a novel right now, do you know how that will end up when you begin?
In terms of plot,
plot or character arc or whatever.
I like to have a moment. I'm almost always firm about the final moment, but that's it, except for the first, say, quarter of a project. Pretty much know what the first quarter of something is going to be to sort of kick off.
So you start at the beginning.
Yeah. But I sort of have a North Star to sort of steer towards. But there's always, no matter how short or long a project I'm working on, there's always some long stretch where I have no idea what's going on. I like no idea how I'm going to get from F to Z. And then I sort of have to sort of fill in F to Z as I go.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that also speaks to not knowing, not being able to sort of meet certain genre expectations I'm definitely an exploratory writer, even though I always try to be a structured, know what you're doing kind of person. I always go off the tracks.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a preferred length, a preferred form?
I have to say this was the first novella I've ever written, and I've written things that pretty much at every other length, except this was the first time. This novella is 35,000 words, for what it's worth. And I really enjoyed it. Of course, it's like the hardest thing to sell.
It's the hardest thing to sell, yeah. Although so many writers say it's the best form to write.
It is. It was incredibly satisfying, and this was. It was very. It was one of the easiest things in terms of, certainly based on the length that I've ever written. And lo and behold, there's not a big market for novellas, but it was very deeply satisfying.
But there are so many independent publishers out there now.
Sure.
The biggest publisher that's been taking a chance is Tor Books.
Yeah.
Who have to be commended for seeking out and publishing
love their novella line. It's super exciting. I love how well they're printed and marketed. They have an incredible product. This, I think, was too explicit.
Yeah. And Ace used to do that in the 70s with Ace Doubles when Terry Carr was the editor there. And then they just... after he died prematurely, it sort of festered, and the form festered in a way. So I'm so pleased. Now, for a while, Tor tried to do Tor doubles, and it didn't work for some reason. But then all of a sudden they decided, let's do single works under the... it's not a different imprint, but just, a novella between two covers. And they have been putting out some of the best damn stuff.
100%. I think technically they're Tor.com, whatever. I don't even understand the full distinction between Tor.com and Tor. But
one's an imprint within the other.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm looking at a book from Lethe Press.
Of course Tor.com is part of Tor. But I think they're,
Tor.com was originally their online division.
Yeah, but then that's how those novellas are actually in print.
There's
a little bit of just a hair's breadth distinction.
Yeah.
And they're incredible. They're so well done. They're so well marketed. They have great covers. I think it's, I don't know if it's Irene Gallo who does them all.
It is.
Yeah. They're.
Although actually I think she got promoted.
Yeah. She's.
Now I think she's
on
a queen.
Now.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
I don't think I would have tried to write a novella if it wasn't for the success of these Tor.com novellas. I think they're
now,
just...
how did you pitch Steve Berman? Because these are not Tor.com. This is Lethe Press, which has been around for, 30 years, something like that. Last time Steve was on the show was like 25 years ago. And although I have people... who, Rick Bowes and A.C. Wise and and folk like that who have been published. And Allison Wise, who will be reading next month at the Review of Science Fiction Readings, along with Hildy Silverman. She has done a novella through Lethe Press.
Yeah.
And
at least one collection as well.
Yes.
With them. They're the go-to queer speculative fiction, imprint in general. Although, Tor does that. It's become much more of a thing, but you feel like with
it's become more accepted. But Steve made it
yes,
as you said, the go-to
place.
That was
the place, and I just knew that
I just knew
that he would get it, and he did.
As he always has, from the beginning with Chris Barzak and writers like that, you just don't have to even worry about the conversation with the editor.
Exactly. Yeah.
Do you suppose you could make this person, a little more? The one thing a lot of writers have to deal with now is age. Because, and actually a good thing about something being... queer fiction is that you assume that they're of an age of sexuality, at least. But so many people turn in books, or your lead character's 25 or 30 or something like that, and the editor or publisher will say, can you make them like 18? Because then we can sell it as YA, and that market is boom. So you can see where there will always be a desire for a publisher to try to manipulate a character or something. And by the way, sometimes they're right. You know, it depends on Barbara, my partner, Barbara Krasnoff, her experience with her novel, The Whole of History 2065, her editor-publisher, Mike Allen, the recommendations and the questions he had and things that he wanted to change, and let's write a story that, you know, an episode here and there, was just a fabulous experience. Some of these people are good. Steve Berman is good.
Yeah.
And a lot of the people at Tor are good.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
that's not we're citing this on the air because that's not common.
Yeah, I mean we're in an interesting time now. I mean, there's a lot of people who are looking for diverse and different voices and which is obviously great, but it's not enough to just be for me at least, it's not enough to just have your diversity points, like in terms of whatever your main character is. For me, being, you know, telling a story that's about speaking from my own point of view, a queer experience, is that the story has to be told in that way. It's not just about the X, Y, and Z of your protagonist. Mm-hmm. Like, the story has to be told from a queer point of view in terms of the language, in terms of the structure. Like, let's queer the whole experience. Mm-hmm. Let's not just tell the same old story. Let's not do, like, the Joseph Campbell...
Oh, God, yes.
Hero's right. Journey with a queer... You know, that's... You know what? That's... To be honest, that's lovely for middle grade. Might be lovely for young adult. That's great. Kids need that. I'm an adult. I don't want a same old... a regular story with just like, oh, the main character's gay or lesbian or whatever. I want something different. And it's not just about diversity for diversity's sake. I want the whole thing to be queered.
I think that is a great aspiration. I wonder how easy that is for creators to get that happen in the mainstream. There are people that are trying to diversify the cultures they work with, even at Disney, or perhaps even in some ways, especially at Disney, when you take a look at the casting they're doing, even in cartoons, they are diversifying. They have not gone... Disney as a producer, yeah, the stuff that they're going to end up putting on Hulu or certain, you know, out through one of their many movie companies, Miramax being one of them, Touchstone being another, they have tentacles in more places than so many people realize. And there's some pretty controversial stuff that falls within the octopus that is Disney.
Yeah.
But the question is, how long before it goes beyond being a joke on Will and Grace?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or something like that. And I'm still having problems. This is a conversation that I have with so many people on the air. I don't like the Q word because I was trained to loathe it. I come from an era in which the word queer is a pejorative.
Well, you know what, Jim? You are of your age, and I'm of my age. which, speaking for me, I'm 45. And then there are people.
So you're 20 years younger. Just
yeah.
Like
okay.
Listeners know.
So you're, and then 20 years younger than me. Also don't like it because it doesn't describe enough people's experiences. So,
enough of the
wide
world.
So they do the yeah. So they do the alphabet. So,
in the alphabet. What's the matter with you, Lister? What are you grinning at?
So actually, there's also I'm actually like.
You know what term I like? Quilt bag.
Yeah, I
have you heard that one?
Yes, of course. I don't like the alphabet. I like the Q word, as you said, because for me that's just that. That covers everything for me, but for some people 20 years younger than me also don't like that because they don't think it's
encompassing enough.
Yeah, but for yeah, so there you have it.
And this is what happened with gay, yeah. where gay, which is the word that I grew up with, the people around me, people started saying, well, that just refers to men. No. No, I'm sorry. The women I knew, Joanna Russ and folk like that, no.
Yeah.
Gay meant gay women, gay men. It didn't matter.
But there's so many more things.
And it's also to me, it was also a more joyful word. Whereas in the high school that I dropped out of. The rougher guys in the school, you know, who were bored with their time are, hey, listen, let's go over to 37th row and roll some queers.
Yeah, sure. Smear the queer. You remember that?
No.
Oh, yeah, that was like
that may have been a little.
It was like a game that you would play,
When you roll a queer, there's no game involved. Yeah, there's violence, yeah. And only violence.
Yeah,
involved.
It's a it's a reclamation of language. It's my go-to term.
Yeah.
It's how I describe myself, and I also like I like that it's not so overly defining, like that.
I appreciate the concept of reclamation of language. The problem is that there are words that people reclaim. Richard Pryor reclaimed a particular word which nobody is allowed to use in any media or print at all, but.
I haven't violated any terms here, have I?
I'll let you know.
But that was.
And I have a red button right over there.
The Q word. It's a common. Yeah, it's okay.
I use it myself because it is common parlance.
Yeah, okay.
But it's still, it still conjures up. The fact that I learned the term outside of like reading Lovecraft and all
yes.
the weird fiction that was queer.
Yes.
There was something queer about the guy.
Yeah.
My stomach is funny. It feels queer. I had a queer feeling about the day when I woke up. Aside from all of which are very evocative terms, which now in a way those terms aren't useful to us anymore. So while it has been it's not reclamation because it was never that. It was a dirty word. It was a pejorative. It was a nasty thing. There is a word. I am Jewish. I come from a Holocaust survivor. I'm the son of two Holocaust survivors. And if somebody tried to reclaim the K word, I would have a lot of problems with that.
It's different, though. I mean, I'm as a Jew, I'm also familiar with the K word, and it's different.
I explain. Okay.
The K word and
I'm going to say A, I believe you. B, I don't understand it.
The difference between the K word and the N word and the Q word, the Q word.
Queer.
Yes, I said it before and I'll say it again.
And I said it, yeah. And it is common parlance. And
it is. It's completely common parlance now. It's. I mean,
I'm pleased to have I've had so many queer writers on the show, but I'm also pleased to say I've had so many gay writers.
Maybe it's a little different because the saying queer, maybe it was a non-pejorative word, even though it had a negative connotation before, as opposed to the K word and the N word, and that were just slurs. So it was, you know what I mean? Like
the K word is a pejorative. There's no way around that.
As was the N word.
Not necessarily. In certain horrible parts of the country, you just find it's what it's even.
Okay, but
it was the language.
They were words based in degradation. Let's just put it that way.
Yes, or a degraded society that didn't even realize that they were degrading themselves as they used it. That's the N word.
Yeah. So whereas queer, it was like it was attached to something that people were almost sort of like. It was like it's a more nebulous kind of term. I mean, it was. Yes. So, it is.
Because it
it's not like the F word.
No.
You know, like that's would go in that, you know, that's in that bag with
the French people, yes.
The N word and the K word.
Yes.
You know, that the F word's over there, unless you're British. But those are and queer is not part of that.
You know, it's not even British. You watch the TV series The Magicians, which I so love, and it's coming back soon. You'll hear the F word all over the place.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. You've not seen The Magicians.
I have not.
You have a treat ahead of you, sir.
This is the Lev Grossman?
This is the Lev Grossman.
Okay, I saw like the first episode.
Ah.
You know,
was okay. But, I mean, you have the fifth season is beginning. They deviated from the Lev Grossman novel about episode three. No, in fact, before. Before that, as a matter of fact. It's two different worlds. Just like Jonathan Lethem's Motherless Brooklyn is not Edward Norton's Motherless Brooklyn. They are launching points. One is a launching point. The novel's a launching point for the visual telling of it. It is an underestimated TV series that, by the way, yes, has so much queer stuff going on in it to delight anybody. Feminist beyond belief at certain times, really. Talk about pushing the envelope. And, yeah, the F word all over the place.
Wow.
On a commercial channel.
Wow.
This is not great. HBO. This is the sci-fi channel. Wow. This is NBC.
Huh. But is it used pejoratively or is it used like between friends?
It's between friends. Okay. They start out as college people.
Right.
This is the way they would talk. And, you know, it's just like, oh, I don't give a flying fish.
Right.
only they ain't talking about pescatorial things. Yeah. No, it's their language is just open.
Right.
And perhaps more so than in real life. Well, no, I wouldn't say in real life. What do you expect in a dorm room?
Right.
Oh, and that's what you get in this series. It ain't Harry Potter. and actually, you know, they're not, you know, they haven't been in the school, on the school grounds since season one.
Right.
Around season five, or just about to begin season five. And there are things that happen. There are spoilers. I mean, really. No, there's a thing that happens in season four.
I think I heard what it was.
Yeah.
I think I heard that. Yeah,
it has
it's controversial.
It's very controversial. But what annoys the hell out of me, let's use a simpler kind of thing like the Great British Bake Off.
Yes.
You will then get people who, you know, the thing is on in England 4 days before it's on Netflix in the US. But British press will show a picture of the winner and say, how did blah, blah, blah do it? And I'm going, you know what? If you want to tell that in the story, that's fine. But why didn't you say, how did the winner of this year's Bake Off do it, instead of showing me their face and giving me their name in the headline? There's no avoiding it. I hate that.
It's so there's a problem. Spoilery world, Jim.
There's a problem with season four, which the show, by the way, has not been guilty of. And they have a lot of YouTube stuff and clips and all that. And they even have a sequence of the controversial event in season four that does not tell you what the problem with it is.
Hmm. Interesting.
But the show, the way it is written, the characterizations, good fantasy, a lot of quest fantasy. But it's always about more than that. I have to recommend it. I have to get Liv back on the show. well, he lives blocks from here. But I haven't been. But since he left Time Magazine, he was the tech editor at Time Magazine, and you know, for how many years that was his email address. Don't know how to reach him anymore except through Instagram, and that, you know, there you're one of 4 million people.
That's right.
Because he gets followed. Speaking of following, do you, because, you know, we've got 3 minutes left.
Okay.
Would you believe? Where do people find you online, and where do they find your book and all that good stuff?
Well, you can find me online at therobertlevy.com.
Therobertlevy.com.
Yeah, because Robert Levy was taken. So I'm therobertlevy.com. Okay,
I was going to say by whom.
I'm the Robert Levy on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. So
you see, that's why I had tweeted about tonight's show and I couldn't find you.
I'm just the Robert Levy. I'm the only one, Jim. I mean, you know, the joke is that Robert Levy is like the Jewish John Smith, right?
Yeah,
that name. But yeah, so I'm the Robert Levy on all the various social media accounts. Mm-hmm. It's all my handles. And you can buy my books on
anywhere
Amazon.
Anywhere
where dark, dirty and dangerous books are sold.
Where complete books are sold. I'd rather not promote one account, service over another.
Oh yeah, I mean,
and I buy from the
Dark Empire.
I call it the South American River. I use them for lots of stuff.
You can buy my new novella Anais Nin at the Grand Guignol from the publisher at lethepress.com.
That's the way to go. Push the publisher. People can visit lethepress.com. That's lethepress.com. And that's the way to go because is there an ebook version?
There sure is.
It's available
from Lethe, mm-hmm, in EPUB and .mobi and all the formats.
Okay. Ooh, we actually got at least one pledge.
I love it.
During the show. Thank you very
much.
Let me just see if this gives me information. Can I use this person's name on the air? It was a $50 donation.
Oh, very nice.
And
earning my keep here.
No, they'd rather not be thanked on the air. So I will thank a person from Arizona.
Thank you, Arizona.
Well, yeah, and that's the first time those words have ever escaped my mouth. Or thank you, Arizona. I promise most listeners it's not likely to happen a second time. We're about that point because Lister's coming in for Burn Baby Burn Clapper. He's got you're wearing a new outfit, or at least a big hat. Oh yes, big Lister is a non-discriminating hugger. He hugs.
I love a good hug.
Oh well, uh-oh. Yeah, probably didn't want to tell him that. okay, so let's see. Once more, I am going to deal with the problems of finding stuff on this computer. Where? Ah, there. Looking for my outro music. Let me tell people as we are going off that this has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you all for listening. Please, everybody, be good to each other. That is a necessity for us all. And I will be back. I think I will be back next week. That's up to Linda Perry. If I am back next week, I promise you I will have the writer who is scheduled to read at the top of the show. If not, she, being Randy Dawn, will be on the following week, and it will still be near the top of the show. I'm definitely trying that, Linda. Okay, again, thank you, Robert Levy, for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And we'll do this again. Don't wait for I've got something to promote.
Done.
Okay.
Thanks, Jim.
So, everybody, if you care to write me, I am Jim at OurWolf.com, HOURWOLF.com. We go out, as always, as almost always, with Steel Eye Span performing Sails of Silver. Have a good week.
crew put on hold. The bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pig lurk. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right, and it's right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they still have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. And drag it and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the figs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Burn, baby, burn. 99 Cinco List Alive in brand new studios right here on Atlantic Avenue, right here in Brooklyn, Brooklyn. Thank you very much, Jim Froyne and Max. Hope I'm not too hot. Levels look good. This is HR for Carl Anthony.
On the eye of light, so many miles away. send them away. Shout out to the rhythm, don't keep sleeping. Be the new song, DJ, give it another play. Ready now, we prepare for action. New version, we'll catch and you can't escape. So feed the spirit chanting, give thanks, put your hands up and dance, because dancing is great.